It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. Coming up on this episode, the ACLU sues face recognition company Clearview AI. We'll talk about end-to-end encryption, both in Google's new RCS messaging system and in Zoom. How do they do it? Steve's impressed. Stay tuned for the details.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 769, recorded Tuesday, June 2nd, 2020. Zoom's E2E encrypted design. It's time for Security Now, the show we cover your security online, your privacy, how things work, and a few little tidbits thrown in here or there with this guy right here, Steve Gibson. Of the Gibson
how things work and what happens when they break.
When they don't
and
work.
Stop breaking.
Yeah.
Yes.
Salute to you, Steve.
Leo, great to be with you once again. Episode 769 for this first podcast of June. God, where is the year going? 2020. What a bizarre year we're in. Friday before last, a large team of folks working on behalf of, helping Zoom published their end-to-end encryption design document, 25 pages of aspiration and clearly some perspiration, lots of equations that we're not going to try to do on a mostly audio podcast, but the concepts are there and they're readily understandable. So I thought it'd be fun to take a look at how Zoom is, what they've already done, and at what their plan looks like, the roadmap that they've laid out for how they're going to get to what will arguably be the most secure teleconferencing solution on Earth by the time they're done. So today's topic is Zoom's E2EE, which of course is the acronym we're now seeing more and more, end-to-end encryption design. But lots of fun stuff happened this week. Well, fun if you're in the podcasting business. We're going to look at which browsers still permit drive-by website downloads and define what that is. Google's plan to badlist, notification abusing websites. We're going to take a bit deeper dive, thanks to some research that Lawrence Abrams did over at Bleeping Computer, into all the other sites that are apparently doing local PC port scanning. We talked about eBay last week. Turns out, yes, there's 300 and some odd others. Many of them are substantial. There's also a new lawsuit being brought against Clearview AI, which, you know, I think is nothing but good, because we need the brakes to be put on this and some serious thought to be given to the consequences of this pervasive facial hoovering of all images everywhere, and then AI to identify them. And there's some new facts that come out in this lawsuit that I want to share with our listeners. Some very interesting strings have been found embedded deep in Google's latest messaging app, indicating some future intent, which is intriguing. We've got a very worrisome return of a much more potent version of Strandhog for Android. We also had the refusal of SHA-1 to die, despite many attempts to just, you know, end it. It's just really putting up a fight. A more powerful new USB fuzzer and what it has found. I will update our listeners on some very nearly finished SpinRite work, a necessary sub-project that I've been on for about 3 weeks, pretty much wrapped up yesterday with a little bit more fine-tuning to do. And then, as promised, we'll take a look at Zoom's new detailed plans to become the world's most secure teleconferencing platform. And This picture of the week is not apropos of anything security, but I encountered it when I was looking to see whether last week's wacky Windows 10 airplane was available as wallpaper. And this was somewhere nearby. And I thought, oh, this is, you know, at least it's technology. So it's just too fun. So I think
sort
that's
of
a great
technology
for our listeners.
Sort of technology.
So, Leo, remember that picture we had a couple of years ago? There's a plastic pail half filled with dirt, and there was a rod stuck into it,
yeah.
and a big green ground wire yeah. wrapped around the rod.
Yeah.
And some person figured, oh, well, you know, I was told I had to ground this.
There you go.
So
yeah,
it's I
in
stuck
the ground.
It into a pail of dirt, and it's in the ground, right? I mean, it's dirt. So this picture sort of reminds me of that. In a perfect world, you'd have this pipe going along that needs to apparently go into a pipe that goes into the ground, and it would just do a right angle and, you know, from horizontal to vertical into the ground. But in this world, which is far from perfect, there's a big rock in the way.
Apparently too heavy.
Yes.
For the plumber to move.
And I do not know. I would love to know the true backstory here, how this happened. But maybe if the rock is not movable, it's cemented in place, or as you said, it's just too heavy. But it's a big rock. But anyway, whoever had the chore of connecting the horizontally running pipe to the pipe coming out of the ground figured, well, there's a rock in the way. So, in very much reminiscent of that Three Stooges episode where Mo or Curly or whoever it was in the bathtub trying to plumb himself out and ended up in a pipe cage, this thing does a right turn to go up, then another 90-degree more leisurely bend to go horizontal across the top of the rock, then sort of a 45-degree angle down
to get over the other side
of the rock.
It's really contoured to follow the rock's surface.
It really does. And then another 45 to get vertical in order to go into the pipe in the ground. So, again, I don't know, like, what the pipe in the ground is about, where that goes or where it's coming from. It must be the source of water.
I just hope
and
this isn't
so,
a drain.
Anyway, this... As I said, when I was last week, I was looking for the more sources for the wacky Windows 10. We finally fixed all the problems.
Yeah.
It had the landing gear coming out of the roof of the cockpit and the wings on sideways. And I thought, okay, this is just too fun for the podcast. Okay, but so what's not fun is the surprising state in 2020. Of drive-by malvertising downloads. Yesterday, Monday the 1st, a guy named Elias Stein, who's with the advertising security firm Confiant, Confiant, blogged about some research he'd just finished regarding the susceptibility of our current web browsers to so-called drive-by downloading. It's interesting that downloading can be automated, which is something you may not have thought about before, but I encounter this at some funky sites. SourceForge is one that comes to mind. When you want to download from SourceForge something, you say, I want to go to the download page, and you get, rather than like a dialogue that pops up that says, hi, you want to download this from here? Instead, you kind of get this little green be patient spinner that says your download will begin shortly. And then without you doing anything, you'll notice if you're using Chrome, for example, that down in that lower left area of the browser window where downloads appear, it'll suddenly open up all by itself and start downloading. And you didn't do anything. I mean, you didn't press any buttons. You didn't get a confirmation dialogue. It just did it for you. So that's good if you're at a site where you deliberately went to a page and you want to download something. Not so good, you can imagine, if you're on a site who's hosting a malicious ad in an iframe, and this can all happen within an iframe. So in a drive-by download, iframed script content, which is coming from a third-party domain. That's, you know, it's an iframe to offer some containment, and the iframe points to an ad server that then provides the content on a rotating ad basis. So, you know, that's the way any contemporary ad server works. In this case, it's running in an iframe. But thanks to the fact that JavaScript is able to directly modify the DOM, that's the web page's document object model, that is in the, I'm sure that someone somewhere thought, oh, let's allow, how wouldn't it be cool if script could write its own web pages? It's like, yes, what could possibly go wrong? So this, in this case, malicious JavaScript is able to programmatically define a new download link, an A tag, you know, an ahref in HTML parlance, then click it in order to initiate its own, from the user standpoint, zero-click download. Elia's attention was drawn to this practice when Boing Boing was delivering for some period of time malicious downloads to their visitors using this technology. And after many complaints, Boing Boing disclosed that their site had been hacked. So in this case, the malicious code was placed onto their servers so that it was running in the same origin as the page and had unfettered access to the user's page. You know, very much like if SourceForge was hacked and I went to that download page, I don't know, I have no control over what's happening. It just stuck something in my download directory. So Eli wrote that, quote, over the following weeks, we detected this attack on a multitude of sites. Usually this manifests through a CMS, you know, content management system compromise, that introduces this malicious payload. To date, we've identified the presence of the IOCs, the indications of compromise, associated with this attacker on 15 sites within our telemetry. But a cursory look at VirusTotal shows that activity around this particular payload has been ongoing for at least a year, and that these command and control domains are leveraged by multiple variants of the malware. So, having uncovered the mechanism that this attacker uses to drop the malware, Elia decided to conduct an audit of recent popular browser versions to see how they handle downloads that are not initiated by direct user interaction. The inspiration for doing this analysis was the surprising discovery that most browsers will honor downloads triggered from cross-origin iframes, which is, like, shocking. Like, why would you ever want that to happen, especially with no user interaction? And what's more, these zero-click downloads are often still possible within sandboxed cross-origin iframes. Remember that sandboxing is an extra parameter that can be added to an iframe's attribute list to, like, further strengthen its controls. In one example, this has only finally been addressed in Chrome for this latest Chrome 83 that we all got and talked about last week. And in Chrome, I have a link in the show notes to ChromeStatus.com feature and then a long serial number-ish thing. It reads, this is for Chrome. This is in the Chrome status log, download in sandboxed iframes, parens removed, under the security subhead. And it says, sandboxed iframe can initiate or instantiate downloads. It's like, What?
That doesn't seem like a good idea.
Really? Like before last it could? Unbelievable.
Wow.
And so they said, Chrome is planning on removing this capability. Yes, please. In other words, they said, i.e., Chrome is going to block all downloads initiated from or instantiated in a sandboxed iframe by default. What a concept. The embedder may add allow downloads to the sandbox attributes list to opt in. Please don't. This allows content providers to restrict malicious or abusive downloads. Well, wouldn't that be nice? Then they said removal is expected in Chrome 83. This allows content providers to restrict malicious or abusive downloads. Yeah, good. So, anyway, I'm finishing this up under comments. It says, downloads can bring security vulnerabilities to a system. Who's writing this? Anyway, even though additional security checks are done in Chrome and the operating system, we feel blocking downloads in sandboxed iframes also fits the general thought behind the sandbox. Oh, yeah, really? Yeah, okay. Anyway, so Elia wrote, for our study, we will test the mechanism inside and outside of cross-origin iframes. The payload we use looks like this. And I've got the short little bit of JavaScript code just because it was so cute and short and understandable. So basically, there's a document create element. And then in quotes, A. So it's going to create an A element, an A tag, you know, an anchor. And that's being assigned to the variable link. Then link.setAttribute, href, payload.apk. So that in this nascent A tag, the href value is set to, or the href tag, the href name is set to the value payload.apk. So that's what will be downloaded when the link is clicked. Then the attribute download is set to download to indicate what kind of link this is. Then the display style is set to none, because of course, right, you don't want the person, the user, the hapless unwitting victim who's gone to this web page to see anything, any of this going on. So then to the document body, the link is appended. And then in the final line of this little JavaScript code, the link is clicked, which of course initiates the download of payload.apk. What could possibly go wrong? He says, this simple bit of code, or no, this is me talking. This simple bit of code does what I described before. It creates a new link where there was none, sets its download href, makes it invisible, appends it to the existing web page, and then programmatically clicks the link to initiate a download. So what did Elia learn about the status of today's web browsers regarding their hosting of these ad hoc download links in iframes? Chrome 83 does indeed block downloads initiated from sandboxed, thank goodness, cross-origin iframes. But apparently Chrome 82 didn't. Well, fortunately, we all have 83 now. But even Chrome 83, is still willing to drop a file if the iframe's sandbox parameter is not set. So let me say that again. If on all your pages, anywhere you're using an iframe, if you haven't gone back and added sandbox to the iframe, it's not sandboxed. And malicious ads can load some script that will download a file. Unbelievable, but true. However, other desktop browsers will trigger a prompt for the download. This must have been some ease of use thing that, Google thought Chrome should have, where it's just kind of like, oh, look, it's downloading something. I hope that's good. Oh, my goodness. Anyway, other desktop browsers will trigger a prompt for the download, including the security conscious Brave and Firefox. Both of them give you like an OS dialogue. And under many circumstances, browsers will drop the download without any prompt at all. For example, the same payload in a non-sandboxed cross-origin iframe in Chrome 83 will drop the download without a prompt and without any indication that the initiator is not the origin that's displayed in the URL bar. In other words, it's not same origin, it's some other origin. It's, you know, ads are us and trustus.com. And at least here, Firefox's prompting for action is consistent. That is, Firefox always prompts. You never get an unattended, unprompted download. And apparently, Safari attempts to honor and initiate the download, but then kind of gets stuck in some way that he wasn't clear about along the way. And in the mobile world, behavior is also inconsistent. Android browsers are fortunately quick to warn when the download is a file with an APK extension, so they're all tuned up on that. But any other type of file often doesn't receive a prompt. And as we know, files can be renamed after they have arrived, so not clear how much protection that adds. At this point in his blog posting, Alaya places a large, bold call-out reading, "It's 2020, and we can still force downloads that are not user-initiated without any prompt from cross-origin iframes in half the major browsers out there. Why?" Incredible. He concludes by observing, "Within the context of hacked sites, as perpetrated by our site-compromising attacker, ad tech has no role to play," meaning that they are, because they're same origins events, because the site delivering the page is the one that was compromised, as opposed to an ad server running within a cross-origin iframe. He says, "No amount of ad or iframe sandboxing can help to mitigate the last mile of this particular attack because the download is dropped from a seemingly trusted source. So perhaps we should think about always prompting users before a download takes place, along with an informational modal dialogue about the origin of the download." So there he's saying, look, because you can't rely on malicious content always coming cross-origin, even if the browsers were all handling that correctly, which they're not, it's certainly the case that sites are getting compromised, and by using this download automation for apparently ease of use and user-friendliness, maybe all downloads should be user prompted. And I completely agree. You know, there's a point where security really ought to trump automation convenience. Call me old fashioned, I'm sure I am, but I would like to be in the loop anytime my browser is downloading a file into my machine. I just can't imagine that it's, that you can secure things otherwise. So thank you, Alaya, for that research and for a bit of a heads up on this. Also in Google News, they're planning to blacklist, and as I wrote that, I thought, oops, I mean badlist, notification.
This would be a bad day to get that wrong.
Yes. Notification abusing sites. Google intends to shield Chrome users from two types of abusive alerts. Remember, we were just talking about alerts a couple of weeks ago when I saw one that I just made my eyes cross. And Leo, you said, wait a minute, you mean you have to acknowledge this notification to allow notifications in order for the site to allow you in. It's like, yeah, that actually happens.
That pisses me off. That's the thing.
And this is what Google's talking about. They call them permission request issues, which attempt to mislead, trick, or force users into allowing notifications. And, of course, this is the behavior I talked about a couple weeks ago. The second form of abuse are the content of subsequent notifications, which are then used for phishing, delivering malware, or faking chat messages, warnings, or system dialogues. So with the forthcoming mid-July release of the next Chrome 84, the browser will also inform users that these abusive websites may be trying to trick them by phishing for private information or promoting malware. A Google spokesperson explained that, quote, abusive notification prompts are one of the top user complaints we now receive about Chrome. And I have to say, I'm just not clear on the whole value of the notification. Remember that if you allow a site to enable notifications, then even when you're not at that site, even when your browser is not forefront, the notification system now links into the OS notifications, and you see notifications from that site that look undistinguishable from OS-grade notifications. I mean, who thought that was a good idea? Anyway,
people who are pushing browsers as applications.
Yeah, exactly. Although Chrome 84's abusive notification protection is designed to only trigger for new notification permission requests from abusive websites, Google is also planning to expand these protections to users who've already provided abusive sites with permission to deliver notifications. Yay, because, you know, we've talked about what happens if you've already given permission. We've talked about how you can go and go back and audit your notification list. It's not hard to do, but lots of you know, less focused users don't know how to do that. Google said only a small fraction of websites will be affected by this change, but we expect the impact on notification volume will be significant for some users. So what's happening is there's only a small number of abusive sites, but they're being very abusive. So what they're going to do is they're going to get proactive. They plan to give these sites that have been identified as abusive 30 days written notice by email prior to tagging them as abusive. And that'll allow websites owners to check whether they've been tagged using the Google Search Console in order to check the status of their site. They'll have 30 days to fix their content and ask to be resurveyed in order to be taken off of the pending abuse list. But starting in August, they will be actively blocking sites, these sites that have been tagged as abusive. So essentially, they're going to proactively step in to say, no, this is not how we intended site notification to work. Cease and desist, or you're in trouble.
Yes.
I just lost my picture.
You paused.
Ah, interesting. anyway.
You don't need pictures. You never wanted video in the first place.
It just went weird. This is Skype these days. Thank you. Anyway, so starting in August, in addition to that, Chrome will also be blocking resource-consuming ads, which tie up too much of the system's resources without the user's knowledge. Bravo to Google. These all seem like clean, sensible, and responsible actions from the industry's number one browser source. So, as I mentioned at the top, the question of who else might be doing this eBay-like threat metrics port scanning that we talked about last week. Lawrence Abrams over at Bleeping Computer was wondering, as he frequently does, and decided to find out. to determine which other sites might be using the same scanning script. Bleeping Computer reached out to a company called Domain Tools. That's a cybersecurity company specializing in web domain and DNS threat intelligence. So they're the right kind of profile. It turned out that when websites load Threat Metrics' anti-fraud script, they load the script from a customer named online-threatmetrics.net host name. Okay, so for example, eBay loads the Threat Metrics script from a domain source.ebay-us.com, meaning that the Threat Metrics script appears to be coming from eBay, but a query to that source.ebay-us.com domain returns a CNAME record. That's a CNAME for canonical, and it's also known as an alias. In other words, it's the source.ebay-us.com domain is an alias for another domain. In this case, that redirects DNS lookup to h-ebay.online-metrics.net. That is over to the actual threat metrics domain. So as a consequence of that, that's all visible. So Domain Tools was able to provide Bleeping Computer with a list of 387 unique online-metrics.net references that share a similar naming scheme. And Leo, I've got a link down toward the end of this page to a Google spreadsheet list of these names. It's rather daunting when you actually see it. So then, using this list, Bleeping Computer visited the sites for many of the larger prominent companies to verify whether they were in fact performing a local client-side, that is browser-hosted port scan, into their visitor's computer when someone just visited. Bleeping Computer wrote that they did indeed detect port scanning when visiting Citibank, TD Bank, Ameriprise, Chick-fil-A, LendUp, Beachbody, Equifax IQ Connect, TIAA Cref, Sky, Gumtree, and WePay. Lawrence noted that the specific scanning behavior tended to vary from site to site. Citibank, Ameriprise, TIAA Cref immediately port scanned their visitors when entering the main page of the site. TD Bank, Chick-fil-A, LendUp, Equifax, IQ Connect, Sky, Gumtree, and WePay only port scanned when visitors attempted to log in. And Beachbody.com only port scanned when checking out. This detection success suggests that many of the other well-known sites on the list are also using threat metrics and likely scan their visitors at other sensitive times. There are other major names: Netflix, Target, Walmart, ESPN, Lloyd Bank, HSN, Telecharge, Ticketmaster, TripAdvisor, PaySafeCard, and possibly even Microsoft. For those sites, Bleeping Computer was unable to trigger a scan, but it seems likely that the scans may be present on site pages that weren't visited during their testing. Lawrence posted a Google sheet. As you had up there on the screen a second ago, I got a link in the show notes for anyone who's interested. I mean, it's it's extensive. So he concluded his report by noting that these port scans can be blocked using uBlock Origin in Firefox. Unfortunately, uBlock was unable to block the port scans in the new Microsoft Edge or Google Chrome because extensions can no longer have adequate permissions to uncloak the DNS CNAME records. You know, and we talked about this at the time. This is something that the Chromium browsers did in the name of security, limiting the abuse of extensions. On the other hand, sometimes you want to trust an extension to be able to do good things. And this lack of access is something that uBlock Origins quite curmudgeonly author Gorehill mentioned a while back. He was not happy that he was no longer able to do as much as he wanted to. But Bleeping Computer also tested the Brave browser, and the port scans were allowed through. So Firefox plus uBlock is the only effective blocker of these locals. Yeah, I know.
That's what I use.
Where I am. And in fact, something funny happened last night that we will be getting to in a minute.
It is conceivable these are legitimate scans. I mean, this is, as we had talked about last week, a threat scan, right?
Yeah. Apparently, based on Lawrence's feedback from his article last week, many users,
I don't want it.
Right. It's like, I don't want you, my browser, scanning my own computer.
Right.
Hands off. But that's
you have
done.
To trust the source. You know, I see American Express is on here, for instance. It's a financial institution. I think they're probably doing it for a good reason, right?
Yeah.
And, but you have to trust them, like, that they're not going to look at what else I got going on, you know, that kind of thing. So,
Well, so Facebook has decided to require some identity verification.
Yeah.
For high-impact posters.
So I've gotten calls on the radio show. They're saying, hey, Facebook wanted me to send them my driver's license. They're doing that.
I guess they should be flattered because it means that they have some reach in Facebook parlance. Last Thursday, in a blog posted, the Facebook blog was posted verifying the identity of people behind high-reach profiles. This is really short, so I'll just share it verbatim. Facebook said, we want to ensure the content you see on Facebook is authentic and comes from real people, not bots or others trying to conceal their identity. In 2018, we started to verify the identity of people managing pages with large audiences, and now we're extending ID verification to some profiles with large audiences in the U.S. Moving forward, we'll verify the identity of people who have a pattern of inauthentic behavior to Facebook and whose posts start to rapidly go viral in the U.S. We want people to feel confident that they understand who's behind the content they're seeing on Facebook, and this is particularly important when it comes to content that's reaching a lot of people. If someone chooses not to verify their identity or the ID provided does not match the linked Facebook account, the distribution of their viral post will remain reduced, so fewer people will see it. In addition, if the person posting is a page admin, they'll need to complete page publishing authorization and will not be able to post from their page until their account is verified through our existing page publisher authorization process. IDs will be stored securely and won't be shared on the person's profile.
Yeah.
That's, I think, a key that
I'll come
back to.
That's what people are worried about. Yeah, exactly.
Yes. Yes. They said visit the Help Center for more information on the types of IDs we accept. They said this verification process is part of our ongoing efforts to create greater accountability on Facebook and improve people's experiences on our apps. So, this is another – we have a couple more little bits. Actually, the next thing I want to talk about is ClearView that demonstrates, you know, we've got problems to solve. But it's clear that as a global society, we're currently struggling to figure out how to manage this new Internet-enabled social media. We know anonymity is a powerful tool for speech freedom, but that freedom can so easily be abused that some – privacy-protected accountability seems like it's going to be a necessary step as we learn to manage what we have created here. You know, during the week, this past weekend's energetic protest events, many of the authentic protesters were only too happy to share their identities. You know, they were there for what they felt was a righteous cause. But none of those who were looting the stores wanted to be known. You know, everybody was in a big anonymous group, and a bunch of people were taking advantage of that anonymity. And as I said, Facebook's posting notes that, quote, IDs will be stored securely and won't be shared on the person's profile. So, again, I think as long as they make that clear, and as if they're presumably able to honor that, not let that identity information leak, then that seems like a useful thing. It will probably go a long way toward, beginning to get this under control.
And I guess the problem is that people just don't trust Facebook with their personal information, They're worried. I don't know what I would do if it asked for that. Fortunately, I'm
They're certainly using it as a conduit to get access to mass amounts of people, massive reach.
Right.
So I think it seems like to me a useful trade-off.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't know how else you control this. I mean, literally, it's otherwise completely uncontrolled.
Yeah, troll farms.
So, Clearview AI is in the crosshairs once again. This time, it's the ACLU that's decided that Clearview AI needs to be stopped. The headline of the American Civil Liberties Union website is full of righteous indignation with the headline, "We're taking Clearview AI to court to end its privacy-destroying face surveillance activities." Then the subhead is, "The company's surveillance activities are a threat to privacy, safety, and security." But I need to stop here for just a moment to note the oh-so-delicious irony of the fact that upon visiting www.aclu.org last night, my trusted Firefox browser popped up a warning which reads, "Firefox blocked a fingerprinter on this site." I'm not kidding, Leo. I had the presence of mind to snap the screen, and it's in the show notes here.
Let me get it, yeah. I see this all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. So, that's just too wonderful. The American Civil Liberties Union, on their website, which is about to get all wound up over the, quote, privacy-destroying surveillance activities of the Clearview AI company, is using web browser fingerprinting to track their site's visitors.
Do they tell you what fingerprinter or what technology it's using on that?
I didn't type. I didn't go any further.
Yeah.
So we don't know. I don't have any backstory on this. The ACLU
is ads on that site. So
no, they are a highly charged, often controversial organization. So perhaps they have some security or safety related reason for adding non-browser cookie tracking to their site, but I thought it was funny to receive this warning when going to a pro-privacy, anti-surveillance site like the ACLU. It's like, yes, but we're going to try to fingerprint you. Anyway, but that aside, I agree that Clearview's arbitrary photo, facial surveillance, and image recognition capability represents another aspect of the internet we have unleashed. When you combine an internet-connected camera in everyone's pocket with real-time fixed camera surveillance, massive cloud storage, and cloud computing resources, you get consequences that were unintended. When, you take a whole bunch of innocent things, but when you aggregate them, you can end up with something that's not so innocent in aggregate. So what the ACLU wrote and posted last Thursday does contain some new information, because a couple things that I said, what? So I want to share it. They said, and a lot of this we know, but this sort of sets up for this new stuff. For several years, a little-known startup based in New York has been amassing a database of billions of our face prints, which is the term they're using here, unique biometric identifiers akin to a fingerprint or DNA profile, drawn from personal photos on our social media accounts and elsewhere online. The company has captured these face prints in secret, without our knowledge, much less our consent, using everything from casual selfies to photos of birthday parties, college graduations, weddings, and so much more. Unbeknownst to the public, this company has offered up this massive face print database to private companies, police, federal agencies, and wealthy individuals, allowing them to secretly track and target whomever they wish using facial recognition technology. That company is Clearview AI, and it will end privacy as we know it if it isn't stopped. We're taking the company to court in Illinois today on behalf of organizations that represent survivors of sexual assault and domestic violence, undocumented immigrants, and other vulnerable communities. As the groups make clear, Clearview's face surveillance activities violate the Illinois Biometric Information Privacy Act, BIPA, which of course we've discussed extensively here in the past, and represent an unprecedented threat to our security and safety. Face recognition technology offers a surveillance capability unlike any other technology in the past. It makes it dangerously easy to identify and track us at protests, AA meetings, counseling sessions, political rallies, religious gatherings, and more. For our clients, organizations that serve survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault, undocumented immigrants, and people of color, this surveillance system is dangerous and even life-threatening. It empowers abusive ex-partners and serial harassers, exploitive companies, and ICE agents to track and target domestic violence and sexual assault survivors, undocumented immigrants, and other vulnerable communities. By building a mass database of billions of face prints without our knowledge or consent, Clearview has created the nightmare scenario that we've long feared and has crossed the ethical bounds that many companies have refused to even attempt. Neither the United States government nor any American company is known to have ever compiled such a massive trove of biometrics. And there I would say the operative word is known to have. But adding fuel to the fire, get this, Clearview sells access to a smartphone app that allows its customers, and even those using the app on a trial basis, to upload a photo of an unknown person and instantaneously receive a set of matching photos. And we know that behind those photos is a rather extensive set of information that Clearview has amassed from the source of all these photos. So you get names and addresses and other available information. They said Clearview's actions clearly violate BIPA. The law requires companies that collect, capture, or obtain an Illinois resident's biometric identifier, such as a fingerprint, face print, or iris scan, to first notify that individual and obtain their written consent. Clearview's practices are exactly the threat to privacy that the legislature intended to address and demonstrate why states across the country should adopt legal protections like the ones in Illinois. In press statements, Clearview has tried to claim its actions are somehow protected by the First Amendment. Clearview is as free to look at online photos as anyone with an internet connection. But what it can't do is capture our face prints, uniquely identifying biometrics from those photos without consent. That's not speech. It's conduct that the state of Illinois has a strong interest in regulating in order to protect its residents against abuse. If allowed, Clearview will destroy our rights to anonymity and privacy and the safety and security that both bring. People can change their names and addresses to shield their whereabouts and identities from individuals who seek to harm them, but they can't change their faces. That's why we're teaming up with lawyers at the ACLU of Illinois and the law firm of Edelson PC, a nationally recognized leader in consumer privacy legislation, to put a stop to Clearview's egregious violations of privacy. We're asking an Illinois state court to order the company to delete face prints gathered from Illinois residents without consent and to stop capturing new face prints unless it complies with the Illinois law. There is a groundswell of opposition to face surveillance technology, and this litigation is the latest chapter in an intensifying fight to protect our privacy rights against the dangers of this menacing technology. Across the nation, the ACLU has been advocating for bans on police use of face recognition technology, leading to strong laws in places like Oakland, San Francisco, and Berkeley, California, and Springfield in Cambridge, Massachusetts, as well as a statewide prohibition on the use of the technology on police body cams in California. We won't let companies like Clearview trample on our right to privacy. So, they, like others who have sued previously, are using Illinois' BIPA law, since, as we know, it makes the strongest case. And any ruling that might arise from this will likely be challenged and appealed and may finally wind up in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. And as with the encryption question, that's probably for the best, since someone, and it's the responsibility ultimately of our Supreme Court, needs to create some laws to guide us forward. I just hope they are good laws, because this is still the early days. We're not at the beginning of the end or the end of the beginning. I believe we're still at the beginning of the beginning, and you know, there's a lot more to happen with as technology continues to progress and enable things that, you know, just weren't feasible before. We've got insanely inexpensive mass storage, incredibly inexpensive and ever more potent AI to do image comparison. And of course, everything is glued together with cloud stuff. So, you know, we need to decide what we want, what we as a society want to have done with all of this capability and whatnot. Google Messaging appears to be heading toward end-to-end encryption, which I think is, it occurred to me, an interesting stance to take against all of this anti-encryption talk in Washington, which, you know, isn't going away and clears, you know, appears to be gaining steam. We've previously talked about how RCS, which stands for Rich Communication Services, is the long-awaited successor to the carrier-provided SMS and MMS. We talked about RCS years ago. Last week, the folks at APK Mirror got their hands on an internal build of Google Messages, that the app, version 6.2. The APK Insight team dug into it to see what appears to be coming with the next version of Google Messages. You can just pick up little hints from typical, like, strings in the code. The biggie that caught their attention was pretty clear evidence of end-to-end encryption being added to RCS messaging. So for some years now, as we know, it's been seen, RCS messaging has been seen as the successor to SMS and MS and MMS messages, and a potential competitor to Apple's kind of multimedia iMessage. However, one thing that iMessage and the whole Apple ecosystem offers that RCS could not was the ability to exchange privacy-protected messages that had the benefit of end-to-end encryption. Of course, we'll need to wait for an official white paper before we see how all the various pieces fit together, you know, how Google has solved this problem, because that's not just a matter of the underlying crypto, which is pretty easy. We'll be talking about this more when we talk about what Zoom is doing in here in a minute. But if nothing else, Google has the significant advantage of being a late mover in this space, with many examples of earlier efforts to guide their ultimate design. And, you know, they know crypto. So I would imagine they'll do it right when they choose to do it. And it looks like that's what they're choosing. The APK Mirror folks have found in reverse engineering this latest version 6.2 of Google Messages, 12 separate strings that make it, like, make very clear reference to RCS-based encryption. I've got them numbered and called out here in the show notes. The first one, the string's name is encrypted underscore RCS underscore message, and the string content is end-to-end encrypted rich communication service message. So it's like it's
pretty unequivocal. Yeah.
Yeah. Then we have send encrypted button content description, which is, and the content is send end-to-end encrypted message. Okay, push that button. What do you think might happen? Then we've got E to EE conversion tombstone is a string name, and that string expands to chatting end-to-end encrypted with, and then a percent S, which we know is the typical printf format for expanding a string in there. So the point is it would put up on the screen chatting end-to-end encrypted with Leo, and that's what it would do. So it would declare that. Then we get metadata encryption status, whose content is end-to-end encrypted message, pretty self-explanatory. E2E failed to send retry description, and then that says resend as chat. And that was one thing that the reverse engineers noted, and some of this text suggests, is that something about this requires more endurance. It's not exactly sure what, but for example, there's a string named encryption fallback title, and that string is send unencrypted messages, ? And then there's encryption default fallback body, which reads SMS, MMS texts aren't end-to-end encrypted. To send with end-to-end encryption, wait for improved data connection or send messages now as SMS, MMS. So I guess the point is that it looks like cellular is able to do SMS, MMS, but you need an internet connection and separate from or on top of cellular in order to do the RCS encrypted messaging. Then they have encryption fallback dialog accept button, which when that button will be labeled send unencrypted. We've got encryption fallback dialog decline button, which is labeled wait. Then encryption send fallback body, which reads SMS, MMS texts aren't end-to-end encrypted. To send with end-to-end encryption, wait until something's this looks like a string has data connection. Oh, it's the person, like Leo, has data connection, or send messages now as SMS, MMS. Second to last is if this is proper, Etufi to telephony setting title, and that says let other apps access end-to-end encrypted messages, which is interesting. And then finally, location attachment picker send encrypted content description, and that string is send end-to-end encrypted messages with selected location, and then the location gets filled in. So anyway, there's been no public disclosure that these guys were aware of. I've certainly not run across any talk of Google Messages going encrypted, but it's very clear that there's some focus being given to that. I mean, this looks like it's done, and it's just a matter of, you know, them playing with it off the books for a while, working out the details, and I imagine at some point in the future we're going to be getting encrypted Google messaging when you've got an internet connection. Crazy the way the internet works that way. Okay, oh boy. We have the return of a much more worrisome strand hog, which is affecting all Android phones not running the latest Android 10. They're all vulnerable. So our listeners may remember that it was December of last year, early December, that Strandhog 1.0 appeared. The Hacker News wrote at the time in December of 2019, cybersecurity researchers have discovered a new unpatched vulnerability in the Android operating system that dozens of malicious mobile apps are already exploiting in the wild to steal users' banking and other login credentials and spy on their activities. Dubbed Strandhog, the vulnerability resides in the multitasking feature of Android that can be exploited by a malicious app installed on a device to masquerade as any other app on it, including any privileged system app. In other words, they wrote, when a user taps the icon of a legitimate app, the malware exploiting the Strandhog vulnerability can intercept and hijack this task to display a fake interface to the user instead of launching the legitimate application. Okay, so that was then. Last week, the same Norwegian cybersecurity researchers who found and obviously named Strandhog being used in the wild unveiled details of an extremely critical successor vulnerability. And they've known of this for a while. The CVE is CVE-2020-0096. Again, 0096. The low number of that CVE suggests that it was assigned during the first few hours of the new year. It affects Android OS and allows attackers to carry out a much more sophisticated version of the Strandhog attack. They, of course, called it Strandhog 2.0. And this vulnerability affects all Android devices except those running the very latest version. And that's because they told Google about it at the beginning of the year, and Google was able to incorporate a fix for it into Android 10. But that's only 15 to 20% of Android devices, which leaves the other billion-plus Android smartphones currently vulnerable to this new attack. And I have a link to their formal vulnerability disclosure, and of course it's got the sort of a Norse Viking logo thing on the page, promon.co. And they said, Promon researchers have discovered a new elevation of privilege vulnerability in Android that allows hackers to gain access to almost all apps. Which is one of the big differences. Classified as critical severity by Google, the vulnerability has been named Strandhog 2.0 by Promon due to its similarities with the infamous Strandhog vulnerability discovered by the company in 2019. While Strandhog 2.0 also enables attackers to hijack nearly any app, it allows for broader attacks and is much more difficult to detect, making it, in effect, its predecessor's evil twin. Having learned from Strandhog and subsequently evolved, Strandhog 2.0 does not exploit the Android control setting task affinity, which is what 1.0 did, which is what hijacks Android's multitasking feature, and, as a result, leaves behind traceable markers, meaning 2.0 doesn't. Strandhog 2.0 is executed through reflection, allowing malicious apps to freely assume the identity of legitimate apps while also remaining completely hidden. Utilizing Strandhog 2.0, attackers can, once a malicious app is installed on the device, gain access to private messages and photos, steal victims' login credentials, track GPS movements, make and or record phone conversations, and spy through a phone's camera and microphone. Clearly, this is a huge win for, you know, the state-level targeted attack use case where, you know, they want to surveil somebody. If you don't have Android 10, this can be done to you, is what this amounts to. Whereas Strandhog 1 leveraged a vulnerability in the multitasking features of Android, this next generation 2 flaw is an elevation of privilege vulnerability that allows attackers to gain access to almost any app. Unlike 1, which was only able to attack a specific app one at a time because it needed to have that app named in an XML manifest that allowed also those apps to be found in the Play Store, there is nothing visible in Strandhog 2. So they summed up in some bullet points. Strandhog flaws are potentially dangerous and concerning because it's almost impossible for targeted users to spot the attack. It can be used to hijack the interface for any app installed on a targeted device without requiring any configuration. It can be used to request any device permission fraudulently. It can be exploited without root access. It works on all previous versions of Android except Q, the latest. It does not need any special permission to work on the device. I mean, so this is really bad. And of course, besides stealing login credentials through a convincing fake screen, the malware can also escalate its capabilities significantly by tricking users into granting sensitive device permissions while posing as a legitimate app. And it's much more difficult to detect because it's using code-based execution rather than, as I mentioned, needing a manifest to be bound into the app ahead of time, which made it much more visible. There's no effective and reliable way to block or to detect task hijacking attacks. So the only thing that can be done until you are able to get a version of Android that has this patched, and hopefully those will be forthcoming, is to look for, be extra sensitive about behavior that doesn't seem quite right, that you wouldn't normally expect. For example, an app you're already logged into asking for a redundant login. If you know the app doesn't do that, then that would be Strandhog 2 overlaying the app, trying to get you to log in again so that it could capture your login credentials for the app. Or permission pop-ups that do not contain an app name. I don't know why they couldn't be customized, but they're just suggesting that would be one to look for. Permissions asked from an app that should not require or need the permissions it's asking for. Hopefully everyone's always looking on the lookout for those. Buttons and links in the user interface that do nothing when clicked on, meaning that they present a sort of a partial mock-up of a UI and didn't bother to make it complete, or the back button does not work as expected, because they're trying to trap you there and get you to go in the direction that they want you to. So anyway, this exists. It's real. Google rates it critical. They fixed it in Android 10, but it's going to need patches in previous versions of Android, and hopefully those will be forthcoming. The problem is, as we know, lots of older devices are never going to be patched. And now that this has been disclosed, it is there forever. And it's clearly going to be the choice for high-level actors, state-level actors, in targeted attacks to attack people. Maybe it'll become more widespread. If these Strandhog 2.0 apps can get themselves into the Play Store, then it's not just targeted attacks. It's targets of opportunity. So, again, really a reason to only be using a smartphone that is actively receiving updates. Look at the panic that people experience when their desktop OSs are not constantly on the IV update feed, getting a constant drip of security fixes. We should not consider our phones to be any different. They are pocket computers. As we've talked about, many people are using them now in place of desktop or laptops because they've become so capable. You cannot be using it if it's not getting updates. I just think we need to have an industry-wide change in policy to require updates as part of consumer protection, to require updates as long as a phone is offering useful service, it needs to be receiving, a flow of updates in order to fix these kinds of problems. Hasn't happened yet. We've talked about this before, but needs to. The SHA-1 hash is finally going to be dropped from OpenSSH. The release notes from last Wednesday's OpenSSH update read, "It's now possible to perform chosen prefix attacks against the SHA-1 algorithm for less than $50,000. For this reason, we will be disabling SSH-RSA public key signature algorithm by default in a near future release. In other words, OpenSSH will be finally shutting down SHA-1 as an available algorithm. They wrote, "This algorithm is unfortunately still used widely despite the existence of better alternatives, being the only remaining public key signature algorithm specified by the original SSH RFCs." Now, to no one's surprise, the very real problem is that the world is full of aging network switches, low-cost embedded machines, many running ATMs, and industrial control systems. They all contain older SSH servers that only speak SHA-1. This means that new systems that will be lacking support for SHA-1 will no longer be able to connect as they always could. It's truly a mess. It effectively means that much as we may wish to stop using SHA-1, we really cannot for those applications. Old OpenSSH-based clients will remain for use in connecting to those old servers, but those older clients will no longer be maintainable since any updates to them would remove their support for SHA-1, which they need in order to connect to the old servers. Thus, embedded servers that cannot be updated are holding back updates to clients that would like the advantage of better security, but they can't update. So I don't know what will happen. I guess maybe people will start running two sets of clients. They'll have the clients that they can use to connect with more security, but they'll have to keep an old, creaky SSH client around that still supports SHA-1 for those instances where they need to do administration to embedded devices that still only know SHA-1. Wow. It's a mess. Speaking of messes, what happens when you fuzz USB? You find 26 new, previously unknown flaws, many of them critical, residing in our USB-supporting desktop OSs. We've talked many times about how important fuzzing is as a semi-automated means of uncovering previously unknown flaws in software. I would argue that those who are interested in exploring the idea of being a vulnerability finder for profit, probably the best way to start is with fuzzing. You've got to be a coder by definition. So code up a fuzzer of something and turn it loose. And when something crashes, that's your next challenge. Figure out what happened that crashed it and see if there's a vulnerability there that you can turn into a payday. But in any event, the researchers who built this new USB fuzzing tool used it to uncover one bug in FreeBSD, three bugs in macOS, two of those resulting in an unplanned reboot and one which froze the system. They found four flaws in Windows 8 and 10. Those resulted in blue screens of death. That's always, where a flaw starts to become a vulnerability. And the greatest number of bugs, and those most severe, were found in Linux, a total of 18. 16 of those 18 were memory bugs having high security impact in various Linux subsystems, the USB core, USB sound, and the network. One bug resided in the USB host controller driver, and the last was in a USB camera driver. The cool thing is the researchers responsibly reported these bugs to the Linux kernel team along with proposed patches to reduce the burden on the kernel developers when fixing the reported vulnerabilities. And this is one of the powerful advantages of Linux being open source. Those finding a problem can directly examine the cause of the problem in the source and propose patches to repair the problem. This is not something that can be done with Windows or Mac OS, since those systems are closed source mysteries. Of those 18 Linux bugs, the research team said 11 received a patch since their initial reports last year, so leaving 10 or 7 outstanding. 10 of the 11 bugs also received a CVE designation because it was deemed serious enough. Additional patches are expected in the near future for the 7 remaining issues. The researchers said, quote, the remaining bugs fall into two classes, those still under embargo / being disclosed, and those that were concurrently found and reported by other researchers. So they plan to present their research at the USENIX Security Symposium Virtual Security Conference, scheduled for August of this year in 2020. They've been preceded by other USB fuzzing tools. There was one called VUSBF. There's one Size Caller and USB Fuzzer. So they're not the first to fuzz USB, but they feel that their tool called USB Fuzz is superior to those that came before because it provides testers with more control over the test data, and it's portable to non-Unix-like OSs, so it'll run under Mac or Windows as the host of the tool, unlike any of the other tools. And it'll be released on GitHub as an open-source project following their USENIX talk. If anyone is interested, I've got the repo link here, although at the moment it just takes you to a 404 error. They have not yet put up a page, but they will be. SpinRite, yesterday I reached the end of a surprisingly challenging bit of development for the SpinRite project. As we all know, SpinRite has always run on top of the FreeDOS clone of MS-DOS. The SpinRite version 6.x series, that is 0.1, 0.2, and however many I do to basically catch it up with the technology change that's happened since 2004, will continue to do so, since this will let me get it out sooner to everybody who's waiting. But although that SpinRite will no longer use the BIOS, that's what all this next work is about, it does still use DOS. And DOS can still only boot from a BIOS-based system, and the FreeDOS people have stated that that's the only DOS that's still alive, they're never going to support UEFI. So once the SpinRite 6 series are finished, my plan is to immediately remove SpinRite's dependence upon DOS so that it is able to boot natively as its own OS, essentially. And that will allow it to also boot from UEFI-based systems that will not boot, as I said, any form of DOS. One of the most frequently used words in that prior paragraph is boot, which is where my efforts the past 3 weeks have been spent. I now have a little Windows command line utility that can take a removable USB drive in any possible initial state, already formatted, unformatted, never formatted, formatted with some foreign thing like by the Mac OS with a GPT plus a FAT file system, whatever, with or without any defined partition, whether or not bootable, and replace it with a pure and perfect new bootable system. It runs on anything from Windows XP through Windows 10. I'm using only my own new partition and file system code, which I've just written, so that I'll be able to evolve this code base in the future when it needs to be prepping a more complex bootable drive that can, for example, boot under either the BIOS or UEFI. It was surprisingly tricky to get it working under every condition and circumstance, but thanks to the terrific testing of the gang who's hanging out over in the grc.spinrite.dev newsgroup, it appears, as of yesterday, that we are finally there. once it's finished, that code, because right now I just quickly put it together as a command line exe, but it's all Windows code. That code will be moved into SpinRite's boot prep GUI for easy use. And I spent this much time to get boot prep exactly right, because everything in the future that I'll be doing will be using this code. That the initial spin test drive benchmark, which will be freeware and which everyone here listening to this podcast will be invited to play with, all the future SpinRite work, and also the Beyond Recall secure drive wiping utility, they're all going to be bootable. The utility has even managed to repair a number of its testers' thumb drives that were either dead or thought to be dead or messed up in various ways so that they'd stopped working. So it brought them back to life. And since it also usually recovers a bit of previously unavailable and unused space on USB drives, I expect I'll also release it as a piece of freeware as a command line for removable USB drive formatting. So anyway, that is done, and I will be returning to we're going to do a little work now on using it to boot FreeSB. Actually, it's doing that already, and it appears to be fully functional. I just haven't turned my attention to it until it was time, and I've now got booting nailed. So I'm happy to have this technology. As I said, that's what we'll be using moving forward. And when you use Spin Test or Spin Write to create a boot USB, it'll just work. It just handles all the possible weird things that could go wrong for the user. So from Zoom Communications, we have Josh Blum, Simon Booth, Oded Gall, Maxwell Crone, Karen Lyons, Antonio Marsden, Mike Maxim, Mary Ember Mao, Jack O'Connor, and Miles Steele.
A couple of those names we know well because they came from Keybase.
Ah, exactly.
Yep.
Exactly. And there is a reference to them in the doc. From Johns Hopkins, we have well-known cryptographer and professor Matthew Green.
Wow. Okay.
From Stanford University, we have Alex Stamos.
Okay.
And we also have privacy expert Leah Kistner, formerly Google's global lead for privacy technology.
Pretty impressive.
Their names adorn the top of the 25-page detailed technical cryptography paper they collectively published on GitHub Friday before last on May 20th. That paper is simply titled E2E Encryption for Zoom Meetings. And it begins by stating its purpose. Hundreds of millions of participants join Zoom meetings each day. They use Zoom to learn among classmates scattered by recent events, to collect with friends and family, to collaborate with colleagues, and in some cases, to discuss critical matters of state. Zoom users deserve excellent security guarantees, and Zoom is working to provide these protections in a transparent and peer-reviewed process. This document, mindful of practical constraints, proposes major security and privacy upgrades for Zoom. We're at the beginning of a process of consultation with multiple stakeholders, including clients, cryptography experts, and civil society. As we receive feedback, we will update this document to reflect changes in roadmap and cryptographic design. So, as we've observed here on this podcast, many times across a great many different security challenges, in the end, the weakest link in an end-to-end encryption system is the management of that system's keys. It all comes down to the keys. The task of actually encrypting and decrypting data at each end, given a shared key, has long ago been solved. How often are we talking about the way Apple manages iMessage's keys, and how much does our U.S. Attorney General lust for some form of magical golden key? That's what he wants.
Mm-hmm.
So Zoom's security team has properly determined that the first problem to solve, The first place to tighten things is with the system's key management. Once you have that, then the next weak link is identity, verifying that meeting participant identities are not being spoofed or forged. But it makes no sense to worry about that before you know that the resulting keys are safe. So here's how Zoom describes the operation of their current system, the one they have now. They said Zoom meetings currently use encryption to protect identity, data for meeting setup, and meeting contents. Zoom provides software for desktop and mobile operating systems and embeds software in Zoom Room devices. In this document, when we refer to Zoom clients, we include all of these various forms of packaging. Crucially, these are systems to which we can deploy cryptographic software. Zoom Meetings also supports web browsers through a combination of WebRTC and custom code. If enabled, Zoom Meetings support the use of clients not controlled by Zoom, namely phones using the public switched telephone network, the acronym, you know, or the abbreviation PSTN, and room systems supporting SIP and H323, you know, IP phones technology. They said in the meeting settings, as opposed to webinars, Zoom supports up to 1,000 simultaneous users. Webinars, I didn't realize, Leo, they can be 50,000 people in a webinar.
Yeah.
Woo! When a Zoom client gains entry to a Zoom meeting, it receives a 6-bit per meeting key created by Zoom's servers, which retain the key to distribute to participants as they join. In the version of Zoom's meeting encryption protocol set for release on May 30th, so that has already happened. That was, last Saturday, 3 or 4 days ago. This per meeting key is used to derive a per stream key. Okay, so essentially what they originally had when we first started talking about Zoom, when coronavirus hadn't yet happened, was a single key which the server created, which was simply distributed to all the clients who joined in order to use that for encryption and decryption. So yes, it was encrypted. It technically was end to end, but practically the server made the key. So it was no mystery to anybody within the Zoom infrastructure. One of the things that is clearly necessary is to arrange to blind Zoom's infrastructure to the key being used by the clients to communicate, so that the infrastructure is simply transiting pre-encrypted data that it is unable to see into. But they made an interim change on Saturday, May 30th. The per meeting key, which used to just be one, is now being used. To derive a per stream key by combining the per meeting key with a non-secret stream ID using an HMAC. Each stream key is used to encrypt audio video UDP using now AES in GCM mode. Remember, they were using electronic codebook, which is not very secure, or at least it leaks information about the plain text, so GCM is way stronger. With each client emitting one or more uniquely identified streams, those packets are relayed and multiplexed via one or more multimedia routers. They call them MMRs, multimedia routers, within Zoom's infrastructure. The MMR servers do not decrypt these packets to route them. There's no mechanism to rekey a meeting. Video conferencing systems in which the server relies on plain text access to the meeting content to perform operations, such as multiplexing, would be exceptionally difficult to secure end-to-end. You know, you're asking for something that isn't end-to-end. In this design, we take advantage of the fact that the Zoom servers do not require any access to meeting content, allowing end-to-end security at exceptionally large scale. And they put in some caveats, of course. If telephones or IP phone clients are authorized to join, in that case, the MMR, the multimedia router, provides the per-meeting encryption key to specialized connection servers within Zoom's infrastructure. These servers act as a proxy. They decrypt and composite the meeting content streams in the same manner as a Zoom client, and then re-encode the content in a manner appropriate for the connecting client. Zoom's optional cloud recording feature works similarly, recording the decrypted streams and hosting the resulting file in Zoom Cloud for the user to access. In the current design, Zoom's infrastructure brokers access to the meeting key. So anyway, they're basically saying if you have a client that is unable to have the capability of doing the encryption decryption, if it's a dumb client like a telephone or an IP phone that just that all it can do is receive and transmit standard data, then they will proxy for that client, and then the link to the client is unencrypted because the client doesn't support encryption. They finish. This current design provides confidentiality and authenticity for all Zoom data streams, but it does not provide true end-to-end encryption as understood by security experts due to the lack of end-to-end key management. In the current implementation, a passive adversary who can monitor Zoom's server infrastructure and who has access to the memory of the relevant Zoom servers may be able to defeat encryption. The adversary can observe the shared meeting key, derive session keys, and decrypt all meeting data. Again, you got to be at Zoom to do that, but still. Zoom's current setup, as well as virtually every other cloud product, relies on securing that infrastructure in order to achieve overall security. End-to-end encryption, using keys at the endpoints only, allows us to reduce reliance on the security of Zoom's infrastructure. And that's where they will be heading. So they divided the task of getting from where they are now to where they want to go into four successive phases. And this 25-page document, I saw you had the top of it, Leo. If you scroll down about not that far, like a third of the way, you start hitting all the crypto equations, and it's like, yeah, woo, cool. Okay. it's all there, but it's really not necessary. I mean, essentially, we know how to do crypto now. There's no way for me to discuss the detailed design of the various algorithms on an audio podcast, and there's a large amount of it. But that doesn't really matter, because when it's done correctly, it works. And everybody who's there knows how to do it correctly. The overall architecture is the key, and that can be usefully characterized. So the four phases are client key management, identity, a transparency tree, and real-time security. The transparency tree is what the Keybase guys brought to the party, as we'll see in a second. So let's look at what they've explained about each of those briefly. The first phase, they said, in the first phase, we will roll out public key management, where every Zoom application generates and manages its own long-lived public-private key pair. Those private keys are known only to the client. From here, we will upgrade session key negotiation so that the clients can generate and exchange session keys without needing to trust the server. And we know we've talked often about how that's done. Diffie-Hellman key agreement, where in total view, you're able to look at the data going in each direction, allows the endpoints to arrive at a mutually known key, but nobody looking at the data going back and forth is able to derive derive anything of use. So that we are able to do. They'll be adding that in this first phase. They said in this phase, a malicious party could still inject an unwanted public key into the exchange. So that's a good point, that this is not that because authentication is still weak, there is the authentication is phase two, identity. So as we know, public key crypto allows it assumes you're exchanging with the right person. If a man in the middle does a double exchange with each endpoint, then they don't know that they haven't exchanged with the endpoints themselves. They've exchanged with a man in the middle who now is able to essentially negotiate separate keys with each of them and is able to form a bridge through which to decrypt in the middle. So they're taking this step at a time, strengthening the infrastructure as they go. They said, we offer meeting security codes as an advanced feature, and that's we've talked about this too in the past. So motivated users can verify these public keys. The security to be achieved here will approximate those of Apple's FaceTime and iMessage products. We talked about this, I think, both Threema and there have been a number of messaging systems where you're able to, over the channel, you're able to say, I'm going to, you know, let's verify that, like, our fingerprints. And so each of the endpoints is able to verify the fingerprint, which cuts out or at least would immediately alert to any man in the middle. At the moment, that's a manual process. Thus, they said motivated users, they'll be making it automatic. So they said the primary improvement in phase one is that a server adversary must now become active rather than passive to break the protocol. In phase one, we will support native Zoom clients and Zoom rooms. We will not support web browsers, dial-in phones, and other legacy devices. There also will be no support for join before host, cloud recording, and some other Zoom features. Anyway, so I had a note here. I said, so phase one takes them from the current encrypted system where the individual client encryption keys could be captured by a passive observer at the Zoom server to a system where Diffie-Hellman secure key establishment is used to blind a passive observer to the client's session keys. Phase two, identity. They wrote, in the first phase, clients trust Zoom to accurately map usernames to public keys. And, of course, you're also trusting that there's no active attacker. They said a malicious Zoom server, in theory, has the ability to swap mappings on the fly to trick participants into entering a meeting with imposters. In phase two, we will introduce two parallel mechanisms for users to track each other's identities without trusting Zoom servers. For users authenticating to Zoom via single sign-on, we will allow the single sign-on identity provider to sign a binding of a Zoom public key to a single sign-on identity and to plumb this identity through to the UI. Unless the single sign-on or the identity provider has a flaw, Zoom cannot fake this identity. So in other words, that's saying that if the UI will be able to attest to the identity of the person on the other end by verifying the signature of the other user's single sign-on identity provider in order to say, yep, there's no way this isn't the right guy, at least as far as single sign-on goes. Or, second, we allow users to track contacts' keys across meetings. That is, the key should be static over time because it's created once in the client. They said this way, the UI can surface warnings if a user joins a meeting with a new public key. And again, we've seen, for example, Signal, you can turn on an alert to be alerted if the user's key ever changes. It's like, okay, that shouldn't happen. That could be an active attack. So this tightens up security in a way similar to other, you know, semi-identity managed messaging systems, like I mentioned, Signal and Threema, by remembering previous keys and letting you know if they changed. Phase three, a transparency tree. They say in the third phase, we will implement a mechanism that forces Zoom servers and single sign-on providers to sign and immutably store any keys that Zoom claims belong to a specific user. Basically, Zoom becomes a clearinghouse, forcing Zoom to provide a consistent reply to all clients about these claims. In other words, in phase two, it was up to the user to verify the key of the other end. Now, Zoom is going to be involved in that. It will maintain, very much like a certificate transparency log, it will maintain a log of all the keys of all the clients, that is the public keys, not the private keys, and proactively take measures. They said each client will periodically audit the keys that are being advertised for their own account and surface new additions to the user. That is, you know, if something new appears for their account, it's like, wait a minute, somebody is impersonating you. Additionally, auditor systems can routinely verify and sound the alarm on any inconsistencies within their purview. In this scenario, if Zoom were to lie about Alice's keys, say in order to join a meeting with which Alice is invited to, it would have to lie to everyone in a detectable way. They wrote, we will obtain these guarantees by building a transparency tree similar to those used in certificate transparency and Keybase. During this phase, we will also provide the capability for meeting leaders to upgrade a meeting to end-to-end encrypted after it has begun, provided that all attendees are using the necessary client versions and incompatible features are not in use. Such incompatible features include dial-in phones, IP phone, room systems, and cloud recordings. Meetings that cannot be upgraded will have the option grayed out. We will also re-enable join before host mode, allowing people to show up before the host logs in. And finally, phase four, real-time security. Consider this hypothetical attack against the phase three design. A malicious Zoom server introduces a new ghost device for Bob. A user who does not have their identity provider vouch for their identity. A new ghost device for Bob, who is a user, Bob is a user who does not have their identity provider vouching for their identity. Thus, some of the protections that would be available otherwise are not present. The attacker, using this fake new device, starts a meeting with Alice. Alice sees a new device for Bob, but does not check the key's fingerprint. After the fact, Bob can catch the server's malfeasance, but only after the attacker tricked Alice into divulging important information. The transparency tree encourages a trust but verify stance, where intrusions cannot be covered up. In phase four, we look to the future, where Bob should sign new devices with existing devices, using a single sign-on identity provider to reinforce device additions or delegate it to his local IT manager. Until one of those conditions is met, Alice will look askance at Bob's new devices. In other words, if a new unsigned device, one that has not been signed by an existing trusted device, is used, the UI that Alice is seeing will be saying, look, the Bob, in quotes, is not like following the rules here. We're making no allegations to, like, you know, or attestations that this is actually Bob. You be careful what you say, because it may not be, and you've got to have Bob explain why he's using a device that is, you know, that another one of his devices hasn't permitted and authorized and signed. So they conclude saying, across these next four phases of security architecture design, we will end up with a state-of-the-art multi-party teleconferencing system which provides robust guarantees of participant identity, takes all key awareness away from the Zoom infrastructure, and is able to proactively alert any Zoom user when something looks wrong. And one thing I noted that I did want to point out about the crypto details was this paragraph. They said, in an ideal world, all public key cryptographic operations could happen via Diffie-Hellman over curve 25519, my favorite chosen curve, and EDDSA, that's Edwards DSA, over the Edwards 25519 curve, which of course are the technologies I chose for Squirrel. What, 7 years ago, 8 years ago, relative to the others, they're writing now, they're saying, relative to others, this curve and algorithm family have shown a consistent track record for resilience to common cryptographic attacks and implementation mistakes. These algorithms are currently in review for FIPS certification, but, unfortunately, are not yet approved. Therefore, in some cases, like government uses that require FIPS certification, we must fall back to FIPS-approved algorithms, like ECDSA and elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman over the P384 curve. These protocols we use have support for both algorithm families, and for now, double up all public key operations to eliminate error-prone if-then-else branching. Once certification succeeds, we can safely no-op the operations over P384 curve. And I thought, what a clever solution. What they're saying there is that since the operations that are where these are being used are inherently not time sensitive. They're one-time setup things, and they're only being used to establish keys and identities. Why not use both the 25519 and P384 curves in series? Then, once 25519 has been shown to be sufficient, simply drop the P384 out of the chain by no-oping it. And you're left with the curve that you trust. You don't need to worry about implementation mistakes in P384 mucking up the whole crypto. So, you know, nice piece of engineering. I think what they're doing makes total sense. And it's, you know, it's clear to any observer that Zoom is, you know, absolutely serious about offering users continuing the same ease of use, but incrementally taking increasing responsibility for making the system much more bulletproof behind the scenes. End users won't notice any difference. It will continue to operate just as it did before, but they will be notified when anything screwy might be happening. So hats off to these guys and to this team that has put this together.
Did they give an ETA for when this will be implemented?
There's no timing at all.
This is just a proposal then.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, of course, you got the best crypto guys in the world there, so I'm sure it's all well thought out and very sound.
And they don't have to invent anything. All of this is just, you know, applying well-known crypto to, you know, to solve the particular problem that they have.
I mean, I thought I could see if it's a one-to-one call, that's trivial. That's like messaging. That's like Signal. But I thought it was difficult to do a one-to-many call because – or many-to-many call, because you had to, decrypt, right?
I'm stunned, Leo. Yeah. Maybe that's why they specifically said not for webinars, but for meetings up to 1,000. You're talking about a 1,000-way encryption, because you've got to encrypt every key pair to every other user. It's like, yo-ho.
And that, so there's no point at the control point. There's no need for the control point to have a decrypted version. They can route it all based on the crypto keys, and that's all they really need, right? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's just a lot of keys. It's a lot of management.
Well, it's a lot of streams. It's not one stream going up to headquarters and then being sent back out.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah.
It is 1,000 streams from every user, or 999 from every user to all other 999.
I don't know if that's how they do it normally anyway, or if they try to save bandwidth by aggregating and, you know, doing broadcasts.
I think it's the way they've been doing it, interestingly, because they have done end-to-end, but it was just with keys that the server could know about.
Right. Well, and that's what I thought, is that the server needed to know about it to do the routing, but I guess not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really well, cool. The good news is symmetric crypto is what you're using with the key.
Right.
And symmetric crypto is fast.
Yeah.
So, using AES GCM doesn't slow it down at all. Right. So, you know, it's all, you know, and now Intel chips have AES acceleration in them. They actually have three or four instructions, you know, that like make the most time intensive bit twiddling bit just instant.
That's cool.
So
that's really
cool. Yeah, very.
Steve, as always, fascinating stuff. This is a show everybody needs to listen to every week. We do Security Now on Tuesdays, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. You can watch live. I mean, you don't need to, but if you wanted to, or you're just around on a Tuesday afternoon, evening, just go to twit.tv/live. That's where the audio and video streams are aggregated. You can pick one you like. They are not encrypted. You don't need a key. They're just wide open. We want everybody to see them. If you're doing that, join us in the chat room, also not encrypted, at irc.twit.tv. That's a great place to be. If you're going to watch after the fact, there's a couple of places to get your shows. You can get them from Steve. He's got 16 kilobit audio for the bandwidth impaired, 64 kilobit audio, and he has transcripts. That's the one place you can get those really well-done transcripts from Elaine Ferris. That's grc.com. While you're there, check out the place. There's lots of free stuff. It's an amazing site. Easy to get lost, fall down a rabbit hole. So plan some time as you visit grc.com. Steve is also on Twitter at sggrc. So if you want to message him, that's the best place to do it. You can DM him. His DMs are open at sggrc on Twitter. Or leave a feedback at the feedback form on the website, grc.com/feedback. We have audio and video at our site, twit.tv/sn. You can also see the show on YouTube. Best thing to do would be to subscribe. Get a good podcast app. There's lots of them out there. Not labeled Twit, just things like Pocket Cast and Stitcher and Slacker and Overcast. Go Google and Apple have podcast apps. And subscribe. Just say Security Now. I want it every week. That way it'll be on your device. You can listen at your convenience whenever you get a moment, a free moment. Thanks, Steve. Have a wonderful week. Stay safe and healthy. We'll see you next week on Security Now.
Righto. Thanks, buddy.
Hey, folks, I am Micah Sargent, co-host of Tech News Weekly right here on the Twit Network. Yes, Tech News Weekly is a show we do every week, Jason Howell and myself, where we talk to people who are making and are breaking the tech news. That's right, it's journalists, it's inventors, it's app makers, it's everybody who's bringing the tech news in a given week. It's all the stuff you want to know about in bite-sized chunks in a fantastic package. So be sure to subscribe. It's twit.tv/TNW.
Security Now.